minute.
Which I can stand, but
education
not sure if I'm
committee
ready to,
order.
Yet, so.
We're shy. We're not. We do not have a quorum here, which we will need in order to take any action today. But I believe we waited long enough here, and I think we need to get started and hear from our Board of Teaching candidates. Or, well, actually, they're already serving, and so we can get tuned in here. And get some background, and we'll when we get a quorum, we will be able to take action. So, Ms. Ballmer from the head of Board of Teaching, would you like to come to the table and introduce, bring one or two or all to the table? So we'll take one at a time and give you a chance to present yourself and a brief summary of your background and. Why you are interested in the Board of Teaching, and perhaps for those of you who have served for a better part of a year now, what your experience has been. So, Ms. Ballmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Karen Ballmer with the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Pleased to be with you this morning, mostly so that you don't hear from me, but you hear from four of our board members. I often represent, I'm the face of the Board of Teaching, but as you know, I have 11 board members by statute. We are a board comprised of six public school teacher members. You're going to hear from three of those folks today. We have one higher education member. That member is here as well today. In addition, we've got one administrator member and three public members. And I believe one of our brand new public members will also be coming later this morning. You should know that that brand new Board of Teaching member, Erin Azer, has not had the opportunity to be at a Board of Teaching meeting yet. So she's a fresh appointment. But at any rate, I think it's more important for you to hear from these members. They've all been serving since last June, and so have just about a year under their belt, and are great members. I think you'll enjoy getting to know them.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. So let's see. We have we've got John Bellingham and Michael Larson here. Which of you would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm John Bellingham. This is my 30th year teaching. I teach sixth grade social studies in Faribault Middle School and the Faribault Public School District.
And you have an interesting background. You want to give us embellish a little bit more? Because there was one connection I'd like to pursue a little bit with you.
You want my professional background is what you're...
Yes.
Okay. I started teaching in 1977 and taught 4 years and left teaching and went and worked in the private sector.
Tell us about that, too.
I managed a hardware store for 18 months, and then I went to work for an electrical wholesale company for 3 years and had a desire to go back into teaching, and then went into the parochial school system in Faribault for 2 years teaching sixth grade in the parochial schools, and then in 1987 was hired back into the public school system in Faribault.
Okay. Well, very good. What's your desire in relation to serving on the Board of Teaching?
My desire is to have teacher licensure programs, which put out a product of teacher candidates, and we have teachers who are licensed to provide the best education possible for our Minnesota kids.
I think yours was a letter that. You had some good statements supporting that in your application letter. I was curious about your private sector experience and what impact that has had on, you know, many of us. I'm an educator by background as well. But in many times, people who pursue education have not, they've spent their life in school, essentially. And having that experience of another kind of endeavor is, I think, is a healthy one. And so, but I would like to hear a little bit more as to what impact you feel that that experience has had on how you approach teaching.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, no question in my mind, it's made me a better teacher. I'm able to relate to parents. and students about the private sector, and I know people who are not in education, what their schedules are like day in and day out. I know when there is a snow day, for example, that everybody else goes to work. Daycare for students. I know what it's like to work nights and weekends. And so the relationships I've developed in the private sector, people I met at my two jobs, now I have their children or their grandchildren. So, yeah, it no doubt has made me a better teacher. I appreciate education and the relationships I have within it.
Very good. Do you find, too, that there's assumption in some jobs that you know, we isolate our areas of learning academically, and yet much of life is using them and using that knowledge in different kinds of settings. And some people learn a little bit better, and if they're actually learning it in that kind of environment. And that's one reason I'm kind of a champion. Our other one who has been working on the career and technical education is not here today, but feeling that that is of value. And I wondered if you ever found illustrations from your work that have helped you to be able to teach in an academic area, whether it be math or any other kind of related subject. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would say yes, constantly. I refer almost weekly, almost every lesson, as to what it's like in the job world, the organizational skills students will need, responsibilities, effort. It all portrays, and like I said, I truly believe it's made me a better teacher and be able to relate to kids and parents.
Very good. Well, I've dominated the questions here. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Billingham, for being here today. I had a 20-year career in business before I joined the legislature, and I do think it's that background that has made me have a different view of some of the reform things that have come through the legislature from other colleagues of mine, because I so strongly believe in the performance-based analysis as well as the opportunity to bring people from that business sector into the classroom when I championed alternative certification earlier. I wonder how you have viewed your role in the business environment with regard to some of these reform efforts. Has that shaped how you think of these efforts?
Yes,
Mr. Billingham.
Yes, I agree. Probably looking at the requirements, how education has changed in my 30 years, and in business, what employers are expecting as far as skills and mindset, all those pieces blending in, yes, definitely. I would agree.
Okay. Are there any other questions of Mr. Billingham? And Mr. Larson?
Clarkson.
Cut. Michael Larson?
Yes. My name is, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Larson, and I am finishing up my 14th year teaching in the Farmington Public Schools. I currently teach third grade at Farmington Elementary. Start off in Eagan, teaching first grade, and then moved to Farmington to teach second, and then now third. Currently enrolled at St. Thomas in the Education Specialist Program for my administrative license, and so that's, I think, looking at that piece, going down that route for myself.
Could you relate? I was looking through your resume that you provided, and other than assuming responsibilities of the classroom teacher, all of the other things that you've said relate to either the organizations, the union, or whatever activities. I think we're interested in the teaching aspect, and so I wonder if you would fill us in a little bit more as to whether does your other activities endeavoring to work with the profession and the organization of them overshadow your function in the classroom, or help us with that, because this creates somewhat different picture than what you may want us to have. Mr. Larson.
My role as a classroom teacher is to work collaboratively with the team, and then also in the school-wide mission of making sure that we create the product that we can send off to the middle school. In the daily routine, I work with an ASD teacher, as I have 5 ASD students in my classroom, making sure that we're meeting the needs of those students.
ASD is?
My autistic students. also working with the gifted students as well. Got a couple gifted students in my classroom, making sure that I discuss the goals with those other teachers and making sure in the classroom the follow-through is happening as well. So it's that collaboration, that communication, that open dialogue that's important, and then making sure for myself on a daily basis that I'm meeting the standards and making sure that my lessons are focused around that. Because then that's the biggest piece, making sure that our lessons, we always have that end goal in mind. What are you trying to accomplish in a lesson? And that's what I look at.
Okay. Senator DeCrae?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that I'd like to actually have both Mr. Bellingham and Mr. Larson answer. There was a bill that was put forward a while ago called LIFL. I'd like to just understand your views on that bill.
To go first.
I can.
Go ahead.
Mr. Larson?
With the last in, first out bill, I look at it as I see the importance of it. I also make sure that we're always putting forth the best teachers in front of the students. And it doesn't matter whether it's a rookie teacher or an experienced teacher, senior teacher. I think about it, a lot of it too goes back to, I guess, in the teacher evaluation piece, too. Since I'm enrolled in the admin program at St. Thomas, I think about what is my role as an administrator, making sure the administrators are doing their job, too, as evaluating the teachers. And so with that LIFO piece, yes, there are some good pieces and bad pieces, as everything has, but I guess that would be my perspective on it, making it sure that the administrators are doing their job as well.
Mr. Bellingham?
Thank you. Research shows us that students do well with an experienced teacher in class. And experience does matter, so personally and professionally, I was not in favor of that particular piece of legislation, being a 30-year veteran as well. And I'm about performance in the classroom, or teachers, I think, with staff development in place, with district being able to evaluate, with our teacher evaluation in the mix right now. I do believe our teachers are highly qualified and do an excellent job and will continue to. So,
Mr. Bellingham, I totally agree with you that experience does matter. And you've made some statements that there's evidence that contributes to the effectiveness and good results. If the experienced and senior teachers are effective teachers, which I think any evaluation system should be able to recognize, why would senior teachers be afraid of an element of including the performance and not just the day you signed your contract as the deciding factor? Seniority hasn't been eliminated. If both fall into a category of effective teachers, then seniority and the licensure and these other things do come into play. So I've wondered why there's such a concern. It would only seem to me that it would affect people that have for some reason decided to slide to the end. And I don't know if you find that to be the case. You obviously haven't, because you're still engaged not only in your classroom experience but professionally and seeking a role in the Board of Teaching. So, any response to that?
Well, first of all, from the experienced teachers I know of, none of them are afraid of being evaluated. I think the evaluation model, the evaluation piece, must first of all be fair and consistent throughout all staff. And that's what we are working on in the Teacher Evaluation Committee statewide, which I am a member of, to do. Last time, to be very honest, last time I was evaluated was 1989. I would ask an administrator to come into my classroom. I would like to be evaluated. I think I do an excellent job. I know I do. But it's still, it doesn't matter if you're in the private sector or in a classroom, you need to have someone to come in, your supervisor, whoever, and say, here's the plan. Here's what you're doing. Evaluate me. Tell me what I do well. Tell me what I can improve upon. And give me a plan to improve upon that. Mm-hmm. So that's my firm belief. I do not believe experienced teachers are afraid of being evaluated. I think they're afraid of the model and possibly not being fair and consistent.
Thank you for that. Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Mr. Billingham, is your district a QCOMP district?
No.
Yeah. But Mr. Larson's is, I believe.
Mine is, yes.
Yes, and Madam Chair, just, you know, I have continually found the disparity between QCOMP districts who went through such a rigorous process to put things like evaluation and peer coaching into their models, and those districts that aren't QCOMP who don't have the benefit of that. And it seems as though somehow we missed something when we didn't find a way to make sure all districts had that opportunity, because it really did put in place these very important best practices.
Mr. Larson, do you have any comments on this subject?
Based on, I agree with what Mr. Bellingham has said, that teachers do want to be evaluated. And I think it's making sure that the administrators that are doing the evaluations are properly trained. Teachers, myself, I haven't been evaluated for the last 6 years. I want to be evaluated. And going through that, it's important. We are a QCOMP district, and that's part of it. We do the peer coaching. We do the mentors. The facilitators of instructional support is what we call the other folks. And their job, I'm one of those. Our job is to make sure that we're providing the support for the teachers to make them better. None of the teachers are against it. I think with that whole teacher evaluation piece, so it is that fear of the end of it's going to be 35% if the school district, the local school district, doesn't come up with a plan for the teacher evaluation. I think that's the biggest fear, and that's the only thing that people hear. And that's why you do hear these the grumblings, and, like, I can't understand why they would do this. That's why I'm part of our local district's teacher evaluation piece, and that's we're trying to create a plan right now with our local school board as well.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions of these two? We've got two more, at least two more. There's a third one that may or may not get here in time for us to consider. Miss, is it Dr. Clarkson and Ms. Paulman? Would you like to come to the table? Unless there's other questions, but we may bring you back here as we keep this going here.
Thank you.
I just want to make go on record that a quorum is present. Okay, so is Miss let's see, where's my Miss Azar?
Azar,
you're so you are here. Okay. Very fine. Now, Ms. Azar is she's the brand new school board representative that hasn't attended a meeting yet, so don't be too hard on her. Dr. Clarkson is representing the teacher education, and Ms. Palman is the classroom teacher?
Yes.
Okay. Which of you would like to start?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name's Erin Azar. I had no idea it was going to look like this. I thought I was going to be in a small room with like five people. Wow.
Welcome to your education in the political process.
Thank you. It's been quite an experience. I've been a school board member now for 3 months, mm-hmm. and I always say in my former life, before I had children, I was a teacher. I taught 7th grade English at Skyview Middle School. So I'm happy to be here. I'm not really sure what else you want me to tell you.
Would you share how you happened to decide to apply for a position on the Board of Teaching, and what you think you would like to, what areas you'd like to focus on, or what you believe you can contribute based on your background?
Thank you. Well, I guess, when you start doing some things, you start getting involved. You kind of just get in this role of getting involved and continuing to get involved. And this just seems like, wow, I could do this. And, being a teacher, being a school board member, being a mother of two young kids, I thought I have a perspective that sort of brings in a lot of different areas. I was really fortunate to work with some fantastic teachers. I was evaluated quite often. And I would have loved it if any single one of you would have come in and seen what I was doing in the classroom. Teachers want to show you what they're doing. They want to brag, but they're not very good at it. So I bet they would love for you to come in and see what they do. They do some amazing things. As a school board member, one of the reasons I wanted to get involved with that is to be a bridge between the community and the schools. I think it's important to make sure that we continue our tradition of having amazing education in Minnesota. And one of the ways we do that is by having great teachers and supporting our teachers. And that's what I was hoping to be a part of when I was surprisingly but excitingly appointed to the Board of Teaching.
Senator Wiegand.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, congratulations on your fast track, and I'm not sure if this is on TV or not as well, but the
no pressure.
I know, Terry, you're a proud mother of two children, Ruby and Lulu.
Yes.
And with the early childhood teaching the recruitment that's out there and licensing, could you just talk about recruitment for early childhood licensure requirements and anything, because it's a clear policy direction that we want students ready by K, and so many other remedial things could be addressed if they're ready by K, and we want to have as highly qualified people as possible at that early childhood professional rank as well. So just some comments in general on how it might relate to the board.
Sure. I'm also very involved in my early childhood family education system in the Roseville area schools. I was a part of the advisory council before I became a school board member. And one of the things I've been suggesting to my school board is that we actually change the culture and make a bold move and call ourselves not K-12, but P-12 or E-12. We always talk about how important early childhood education is, and I think it's time we really, really put our money where our mouth is. I guess it's not a very smooth way of saying it, but really embrace it. I've seen some amazing things in the classes of early childhood and family education, and one of the big parts of the ECFE program is a parenting component as well. And so we not only have our teachers there that are helping students, but they're also helping parents be better parents and have communications with others going through the same things that they're going through. It's just such a great way to build community, to make people invested in their schools. And I think if you get invested, families at an early age, we're really going to see them invested throughout, or at least that's my hope. I just think it's really important that we really consider that the earlier childhood education when we're considering all of these things that we want to come up with teacher evaluations and really including them in our conversations. I hope that answered your question.
Madam Chair, just one quick follow-up. Anything particular on licensure requirements that the board might address for early childhood?
I'm afraid that just being new, I'm not sure if I can speak to that that yet. I don't know if I have any answers for that yet, but I would certainly be interested in learning more about it.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is relevant to the conversation. I think the comment I would invite any of you to come into the classroom and see what I do is pretty interesting because I'm not a teacher, but and I never have been one, but I have two brothers who are both teachers. And not only is she inviting us in to see how these kids progress and what a good job they do, but to see how difficult their job is. Because I used to do a hockey school in the summertime, and it would take me 2 days every single summer to say, teachers deserve every day off that they get, because I thought that was the hardest job that I'd ever done. And I know that what you guys do is very, very difficult. And it's very, very rewarding, and oftentimes the criticism you get is not deserved. And so I'm pretty impressed by the fact that you made the comment, come in and watch me and see what I do. And I think just based on that comment right there, she deserves to be appointed.
Thanks, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Azar, the comment or the question that Senator Kreif was asking the previous nominees. Any thoughts about the legislation that was passed by this legislature, the so-called LIFO bill? What are your thoughts on that approach to managing staff?
Ms. Azar.
Thank you. Well, I don't know the names of my fellow board members yet, but the gentleman sitting at that end of the table, I thought he had some very, very valid points. I think, and I hope this isn't indelicate, I think one of the concerns is money, that experienced teachers are expensive, and I would be afraid that there might be some cuts to experienced teachers to save some money here and there. And I think that you don't go into education to be rich. You don't go into education to have fame. You go into education because you want to be with kids and you want to make a difference and you want to teach. And I know that sounds very Pollyanna-ish, but it's the truth. And I think that that might be one of the concerns. Do I think there needs to be teacher evaluation? Absolutely. Do I think that we need to consider more than just the age or experience of a teacher? Absolutely. But I think that there needs to be some things we're cautious about.
Thank you. Thank you for that response. The bill that is passed specifically disallows the remuneration to be a factor in that consideration. So we don't know whether it will become law or not yet, but I think there is a concern that we don't overlook the student achievement. But the factors of seniority and other factors are still there when teachers are effective. So, thanks. I think you probably haven't had enough experience. But one of the issues that is before the Board of Teaching right now, I believe, and I'm not sure just what the stage is the alternative pathways to teacher licensure and establishing the rules related to that. So if any of you have some comments going forward here, and we'll let you reflect, you may have not had a chance to focus in on that. We'd like some response on that as well. Dr. Clarkson, would you like to go next?
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation, Madam Chair, members of the board. My background is mathematics education. I've been in higher education for the last 20-some years out of my 32 years in education. I'm very passionate. My research, my personal life is very, very much centered upon the disparities in education between students who can and students who don't have access to not only the education, but also the opportunities that you're afforded because of your education. My family and I moved here 16 years, 3 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days ago. We moved here from California. We moved here, and it was 70 degrees from California in California when we left. It was zero when we got here, and the temperature dropped every day for 3 weeks. It was a learning curve, but we stuck it out. And the point that I'd like to make out of that is that we were new to this part of the country, and there were a lot of things that I didn't know how to do. And the things that I didn't know how to do really centered around the culture and the environment of this part of the country. And it's not because I couldn't do them. It was because I didn't know what was expected. And I think the same thing is true in the classroom with students as well. And I think it's something that sometimes we lose sight of. So when we talk about teacher education and we talk about putting the best teacher in front of the students, that teacher also has to have experience and be broad enough to look at a diverse set of experiences that students bring to the classroom. My area is mathematics education, and I find that in higher ed, I don't make math majors. Math majors are made very early in their lives, usually about fourth grade. That's where students are turned on or turned off. The only problem with that is if they're turned off by math at that early age, they're going to be limited in the number of opportunities, economic opportunities that they have not only in Minnesota, but in the country and in the world. So my particular focus right now is hoping to maintain access to mathematics in early education, in middle school, in high school, primarily focusing right now on the eighth grade algebra piece. There's a lot of things I think that need to be examined very closely, the impact of that legislation. While I think it's something that we needed to do, I also want people to take a deeper look at it right now to find out what impact that really has had on the lives of students. This is a second year, but I've had the opportunity to work with eighth graders because as a 30-year educator, I had a significant amount of mathematics. And I think that's one of the things that I was able to bring to the research on that piece. What is it doing to students? How are schools responding to that particular piece of legislation? How are kids' lives being affected? You know, it's not as though that every student now is going to be ready for algebra just because that's the law. But I do think it's a piece that we need to keep looking at to make sure that students are prepared for that. I'm the first African American to get a PhD in mathematics education from the University of Minnesota. The university is how many years old? While that is a significant achievement, it's not something that we should be proud of. It's something that we should examine and figure out how we can have other people get to that point. It's not easy. I'm going through tenure right now. I'm supposed to have a result in the next few days. That hasn't been easy. There are a lot of things that aren't easy in education, but it doesn't mean that we give up. But there's got to be some other support pieces in place as well. I'd love to have another conversation with you about some of those topics, and this probably isn't the time. But thank you. I had to slip a few.
Wonderful.
Slip. My passion for education, I hope, is evident. That's why I'm here.
I'd like to pursue one thing. You know, one of the things that we grapple with here every year, and it doesn't seem to change, is that I think it's 40% of their young people that go on to college end up having to have remedial education in reading and math, mm-hmm. You know, the two fundamentals.
Right.
And you think, you know, have you had a chance or have you done any of your research trying to get at to the bottom of that as to where I had one. I was at a session and happened to sit at a table with a man who said he was teaching remedial education. It was remedial math, actually, at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, mm-hmm. And he said actually it's arithmetic that he was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that had just stuck in my brain as to what do you see in terms of laying the foundation in those two areas? Because it seems to point back to what we're doing. And in teacher preparation, have we gone off on some tangent that overlooks how kids learn or how they might be get excited about math? Or what do you see? Have you got anything? Because we probably will want to talk to you some more. I appreciate the wonderful perspective and experience you have. But I'm going to let her answer, and then we'll get Senator Hann and Senator Wigert.
You know, there's a lot of funding, and one of the programs that some of my colleagues have worked on was called Reading First. But the challenge I see in something titled Reading First is that it sounds like math is second. And I would implore each parent and each community member to think of reading and mathematics as the foundation of what it is that students need to know and be able to do. As a parent, I have three, and I think that hat has really encouraged me not only in the pursuit of understanding it, but in knowing a little bit more about how it works, especially as I go to parent conferences this afternoon. I think it's important for students to be able to know number recognition, to be able to count. As a mathematics educator, when my children were babies, we counted everything. We counted steps. We counted. And it dawned on me one day that I should teach them the alphabet. But my perspective was very different. My focus was very different. So we did math first and reading second, and they survived. And not only did they survive, but I also want to let you know that because of teacher expectations, because of a situation where the number of students who were at grade level, that number was too large, my oldest was promoted to the next grade level in math because he was close. But because of that fourth grade experience, he was able to take calculus as a junior in high school. And when I took him to Indiana University, he tested out of 12 units of credits because of the opportunity that he had based on a teacher's high expectations for him in fourth grade. Everything fast-forwarded, and because of that one single moment, that one decision, he was able to graduate a semester early. Well, you know what he's doing with that semester right now? He's a musician. He's playing on a cruise ship before he goes to grad school. The opportunity that he was afforded was because of a fourth grade teacher's decision to say, I have expectations for you to succeed, and here's what I want you to do. So I'm sorry, I probably didn't directly address what your question was, but I think that it's very important for us to not only value literacy, but numeracy. Mm-hmm. And when we think of our economy as a state and as a country and as a world, it really is focusing on science, technology, engineering, and math. It's just not optional. And when teachers are not confident or familiar with the mathematics that they're supposed to be teaching, which has moved down in grade levels, then you can't have those same expectations because you can't take students where they need to be. Because if you don't know what the next step is, it's very hard to challenge students. And that's really, I think, where that lies. And until we can move that competency early on, where it's not okay to say in a conversation around dinner, I don't do math. No one will say, I don't do reading. If we're okay with that, then it's going to be business as usual. But until we become not okay with that, until we can say that the math is not optional, then we can expect the same results.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. I have been focusing over here on the literacy aspect of it. It's not meaning to neglect the math, because I think they are both of high value. And my own personal experience was that I loved math, and I was the only girl who took all of the math that I could take in high school and got a top math award. So I share some of this desire and concern and value. I appreciate the experiences that you have shared. So we do need to have further conversation, but I think we need to move on right now. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your application, Dr. Clarkson. I have two questions. One, looking through your packet of information that was supplied to us and the data, you have indicated that you were convicted of a felony. Is that something that you can comment on?
I've never been convicted of a felony.
Well, then there must be an error.
There must be an error.
But I guess, Madam Chair,
I didn't see that.
I thought that was a little unusual, but I had to ask. So.
Oh, well, thank you for bringing that to my attention.
That's a mistake. Somebody ought to correct that.
I've never even had a ticket, so.
It's clearly an X in the box of yes after that.
Oh, really?
Question, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Oh, okay.
But that is an error.
Okay. That truly is an error.
Thank you. The other question is the one that we were asking. Just your opinion about the LIFO legislation or just Senator Olson's comment about the alternative pathways to education. Any comments on those policy matters that the legislature has adopted?
Dr. Clarkson.
Thank you. The alternative pathways, I think, is an important piece to examine very closely for two reasons. I value the traditional method of preparation. I think there's a lot to be said about having the opportunity to learn. But I think there's also the something to be examined when you think about bringing a real-world experience to the classroom. And I think that when you're in a different profession and you make that decision to go into education, there clearly has to be another way of doing it. But I do think that even if, no matter which pathway you take to get there, there are some things that just need to happen. You need to become an expert not only in your content, and that's one thing that a lot of people bring having not gone through the traditional preparation, but you also need to be familiar with the pedagogy. How do students learn? How are they developmentally ready? How are you going to be able to be passionate about your content, but be able to make it accessible not only for students who are at grade level, but students who are above grade level and students who are struggling to become more competent. I think that we need to have a system where we can acknowledge that there's more than one way. It's not one size fits all in education, whether you're talking about teachers or students. As far as the other piece goes, what was it called?
LIFO, last in, first out.
Yes.
Means for layoff.
There's all of my students are graduate students, so all of my students are probably in teaching experiences or have been in a classroom. The piece that's really important there is that if a teacher is being evaluated, it's for good reason, because I think that the work that we do is always continually a work in progress. Teachers who have been in the classroom for even as long as I have, they are still learning new things. And so I hesitate to comment too deeply about it because I'm not familiar with the wording of the bill. But I do think on multiple levels, evaluation is appropriate. Teacher experience is also appropriate. And, you know, just coming up with the best policy, acknowledging both of those.
Thank you. There was somebody else here, Senator Weir.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, I just wanted to commend Dr. Clarkson for being so transparent and sharing her teacher evaluations, the courses, all of the different factors. It's broken all down. You can see she's quite a teacher with how the students have evaluated her in the courses as well as peer evaluations, and that's all available. I've never seen such transparency in an application, and it's a tribute to your own effectiveness, and appreciate that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I think we'll move on to Ms. Paulman.
Hi there, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I understand you don't have a resume for me, any questions you have for me about that, I'd be happy to answer. I can give you...
Why don't you just kind of fill us in on your background?
Okay. I am Karen Paulman. I have taught for the last 11 years in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. I spent the first part of my Twin Cities career in Minneapolis on the north side at both Lincoln Community School and Afrocentric, which was in the Franklin Building. And then I moved over to St. Paul in 2006, teaching in an alternative program, teaching in a middle school, teaching and now teaching in high school. Prior to coming into teaching English in the Twin Cities. I was teaching in North Carolina, and I was in a number of dance companies. So I am a mid-career teacher. I came into the profession because I was remembering my experience as a student in Minneapolis, and I wanted to give back to the community. And then I also wanted students that I taught to have a better experience than I did growing up in the Twin Cities.
And what prompted, maybe, why don't you go on, and what prompted you to seek out or to want to be on the Board of Teaching?
Because I want the teachers that are in front of students to be the best teachers that they can possibly have. In my career in the Twin Cities, I've seen many good teachers, but I've also seen underprepared teachers. And my hope is that we can avoid that. We can move our programs to a place where teachers are coming in prepared and ready to teach the first day they come in.
In light of the previous conversation we've had and the fact of your experience outside of what and the issues you're starting to grapple with alternative pathways to teacher licensure, how has your experience framed your view on how to do that effectively?
First, I think that mid-career teachers bring a perspective to the classroom that allows their students to understand that there is a connection between what they're learning in school and what they will be doing in their lives. Mid-career teachers are able to talk about experiences other than education and how mid-career teachers can connect what they're learning to a profession outside of a school building. Mid-career teachers oftentimes also have a number of connections where they can bring other people from the community in and help students understand what steps they'll need to take to be successful in whatever career they choose.
Are there any other questions? Senator Hamm?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask you the same question that I've asked the others. Is there any views on the LIFO policy that was adopted by the legislature?
Ms. Palman?
I have not been a fan of this bill, but I am not opposed to teacher evaluation. I'm not opposed to moving teachers out of the classroom that shouldn't be there. I'm not opposed to if a teacher stops the process of learning and bringing the best they can to the classroom. I think it is appropriate for that teacher to be moved into another phase in their life. In my experience, in the last 3 years, I've seen teachers exited from the classroom for that very purpose, and I think it was appropriate. In St. Paul, I believe we have a practice in place that does exactly that. I would agree with Ms. Azer that teachers have fear when it comes to this. Teachers have fear when it comes to this bill for a couple of reasons. One, as for myself, I am now considered experienced. I am a tenured teacher. I am close to having my doctorate degree. I am going to be very expensive. My concern would be that if I had an administrator that was not well-trained in evaluation, that it is possible that they would find they, as an expensive teacher, it would be easier to move me out if they needed two other teachers.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first and foremost, I'd like to thank all of the applicants for being here. I really appreciate it. I appreciate what the line of questioning that Senator Hand's going down. I truly believe that the teacher is probably the second most important factor in a child's education, second only to parents and family. So, and we've kind of danced around this last in, first out legislation, which you know, I've worked on that legislation. I think it's a great step forward in ensuring that we do have the most effective teachers in front of our students. I hope that the governor does sign it. With that, you know, I guess I would like to ask all of the candidates who are in front of us right now, do you feel at the moment we have the most effective teachers possible in front of our classrooms? And if not, how do we get there? And then secondly, and I really appreciated what Ms. Azar had to say about the whole family, because I believe that is the most important factor. If we don't have our parents involved, if it's not a family issue, it's difficult for a child to truly succeed in their education process. So with that being said, moving forward, how do we foster that involvement? What steps can we take to ensure that that happens and make that easier?
Now, I appreciate the way you've directed that question, and it's a very complex one, and it could take all of the rest of the time of our committee, and we do have another issue on the agenda. So if you could just make some brief responses to that, I would appreciate it.
Oh, please, let me get my question.
Yes, Ms. Pallman.
Since I've seen teachers ushered out of the classroom firsthand, I think in St. Paul, we have a good program called Peer Assistance and Review. That program works with a teacher to either improve their skills or to share, let them know that it's time to go. And I think that kind of program is supportive and it is effective.
Just, Madam Chair, just a very quick follow-up. Ms. Palmer, does that mean that you feel we do have the most effective teachers in front of our classroom right now?
I think that because tenure has been an accident in some cases where there hasn't been enough evaluation, I believe that we are moving towards a teaching force that will be the most effective. I don't think our tenure systems have been as evaluative as they should have been.
Anybody else would like to respond to it? We won't force you, but
just very quickly, I would say that we're moving towards that direction. I think that teaching is a flexible skill, and it's not something that you have that you ever obtain. It should not be a point where you are the perfect teacher, and so I don't think that we can ever reach that perfect workforce. I think what we do, though, is we move towards that as a goal through continuous professional development, because as the world changes and technology changes, whatever skills we have today are not going to be the skill sets that we're going to need tomorrow or in the next year. So it would be very difficult for me to say, yes, we are where we need to be. I think we are moving to where we need to be, but I don't think that that's possible right now, with all respect to my colleagues and partners.
She was ahead of him. Ms. Azar.
Well, I think one of the things that we can do to make sure we have the best teachers is to fully fund education so that we're giving our teachers the resources that they need and the time that they need to to get the training, and also showing respect to the occupation. So I think that that would be a great step forward.
She's not here.
I would either of the other two like to respond to that, or do you feel you...
Because she's already been appointed.
Mr. Larson, or...
Boy, they got the union talk down to the science. Right off the website.
Mr. Billingham?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Cruz, in response to your question, do we have the best teachers we can possibly have in Minnesota right now? From what I've learned in 9 months on the Board of Teaching is that I firmly believe our higher ed institutions, along with alternative pathways, alternative licensure, at this point right now, I believe our higher ed institutions are putting out an amazing product. With the teacher performance assessment, TPA assessment that's being worked on and guided through and going through, yes, we have outstanding teachers. I believe it was Stanford University put out some data that showed that Minnesota was 48th or 49th in the nation in higher. We're number two in the nation in teacher quality. Number two. Our goal is to get to number one. 48, 49 other states are trying to work to get up to our standards. Our standards are high. Our staff, our teachers are professional. Our higher ed institutions are putting out an amazing product. But what we have is embedded in our standards, in our profession, in our code of ethics. Our teachers are working to make themselves better for our students. So to answer your question, at this point, yes, I do, and we're working to get better.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, I think you had a question.
Oh, yes, just a brief comment, and then actually it's a question for staff. It's obvious we have a very well-prepared and talented candidates in front of us today, and as a former teacher myself, it's very easy to see the personal dedication that you each have to educating our youth and making sure that they are ready to be the leaders of tomorrow. So I do want to thank you for that. I just have a brief question, though, for staff. I was looking at Dr. Clarkson's resume here, and I'm missing page 2, and I'm assuming everybody's packet is, and I would actually like to see the rest of that if staff might be able to get that for us.
Sure. That's true.
Thank you.
Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I missed the testimony of the first testifiers. I was here in time for Ms. Pollman's, however, and I'd like to know how many of you were teachers? Anybody? Okay. And the statement was made about having the best teachers in the classroom, and teachers with experience and mid-career tend to have, you know, more of the tools of the trade. And I just wanted to point out, and again, I don't know how many years' experience those here have. Mid-career, I say, you know, 10 to 20 years, okay? However, going back to the discussion on retaining the best teachers in the classroom, mm-hmm. Every one of you, if you were to get a job this fall in a school, with all your experience and with all your knowledge of education and with everything you could bring to the classroom, you would be first in line for layoff next spring. Seniority does not equal experience. And while the evaluation system is dealing with the effectiveness part of it, seniority does not deal with experience. And you have teachers that have been in a classroom 10, 20 years somewhere, maybe have great evaluations. If they go to another school district, they go to the bottom of the totem pole. Doesn't matter how good they are. Does not matter how much experience they have. Doesn't matter how phenomenally they take what's in the classroom and apply it to real life. None of that matters. Retaining teachers in a layoff only matters by when they sign their contract. And I have concern if you don't find problems with that, because that is not retaining our best teachers in the classroom. That is simply saying whenever you were hired by the school district, that is what determines in a layoff whether or not you will keep your job next fall. And so if anybody wants to make any comments to that, feel free.
Sure.
May I?
Senator Wolf is a teacher as well, so I think she speaks with some passion and some experience along these lines. Ms. Palman.
I was laid off 3 years in a row from Minneapolis Public Schools with the experience I brought. What is important to remember is the quality of that teacher, the one they laid off, is the one that's brought back. I understand the passion you have about seniority. I was fortunately brought back every year because there was somebody who made a phone call and said, this teacher needs to be in the classroom. That's how it happened for me.
And obviously the circumstances changed so that they were hiring. A lot of times they lay off more
right.
than they need to, and then so you were able to be brought back.
Madam Chair, I would say in that situation, more than likely you were a probationary teacher at the time, because mm-hmm. either that school wasn't following the rule of, I wish phone calls made a difference when parents called and said, this teacher is phenomenal, I want my kid to continue having that teacher, but schools can't do that. Schools can only go by when you were hired. Now, if it's a pool of a bunch of probationary teachers that are being mm-hmm. laid off, absolutely. They can pick and choose because they're all at-will employees. They can decide which of those probationary teachers are the best teachers in the classroom. They can't do that in other circumstances. They are purely told by when the deadline is. So if you have a teacher with 4 years experience, 7 years experience, 10 years experience, no matter what the experience is, or a teacher who's a phenomenal teacher and switches school districts, they have zero seniority. So they will be a first-year teacher equivalent and have no parent that can call in and say, hey, this teacher was a phenomenal teacher. Why are you letting them go? Because the rule says, well, that phenomenal teacher was hired after all these other teachers, so they're the one to go. And no amount of phone calls, no amount of parent input, no amount of teacher effort, no amount of teacher awesome performance matters. All that matters is when that teacher signed their contract.
I think this has been a good, healthy discussion. I think you have learned some of the passions of the members of the committee, as well as and the fact that we do care about the teaching profession and believe that the Board of Teaching has a very significant, important role. And do try to keep in touch with what happens. And oftentimes, some of the categories and areas obviously come as a directive from the legislature, as did the alternative pathways, the legislature with the governor's support. So you do have some challenging times ahead, and I think we may be ready to have a motion if there is so we can move on. We have one more item on our agenda. Senator Tomasoni?
I will do that, Madam Chair.
You would like to move?
Moved all the candidates, yes.
You would like to move that we recommend to the Senate the confirmation of the five candidates, Aaron Azer, John Bellingham, Lisa Clarkson, Michael Larson, and Karen Palman. Yes. Those are in alphabetical order, by the way. It was so I hope you will note that.
Do I need to say something special, or was that my motion?
that is the motion, unless you want to, and you're
my
moving
motion.
Recommendation, okay?
Yes. Okay.
But you can talk.
Well, I think that's good enough. I thought they were all phenomenal candidates, and I realize there's a LIFO discussion here, but they can't change the LIFO discussion. They have to deal with the laws we pass, and so whatever the law is at the time, I think that they'll be able to handle whatever the law is when they get to be, because they seem to be very, very well-qualified people.
Okay, is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the recommendation will go forward to the Senate.
Thank you.
All right. I don't
know. Yeah, it was. Well,
thank you very much
wish
for
I could say I was surprised.
All being in attendance.
But I'm not. Disappointed, I guess, would probably be a better term reference.
So, Senator Michelle. We have a bill before us that obviously is way beyond deadline, but the House has, in fact, passed it and sent it over, and we are giving it a hearing. It's relative to school district detachment and annexation proposals. I believe that you have and it's now House File 2939, and I believe you have an amendment that you would like to add to that as for the framework of discussion, or would you like to have some basic presentation before you do that?
Let's have a presentation first, if you would, Madam Chair.
All right.
Members, thank you, Madam Chair, for scheduling the hearing, and members, thanks for your time. Madam Chair, I was thinking it's nice to have a stadium-free refuge here at the state capitol, so I assume that's what this committee will be for at least the time being, so thank you. Members, this legislation, is about school district boundaries, and I think the public policy questions before us is if and how to alter school district boundaries, and who is the decider? If we should do this, how we should do this, and who decides? Who sets up a process to make this happen? Madam Chair noted that this measure was passed by the House, but I want to be clear, the legislation before you does not change any lines. The legislation before you does not change any boundaries. It doesn't alter any school district budgets by $1. This is about a process. This sets up a process. And I think probably each of us, each of you as members of the Education Committee, have your own school district boundary story. Because what we've learned over time is that the school district boundaries don't always line up with city boundaries, with county boundaries, with township boundaries. It could be decades or indeed even centuries old lines. And they don't always mix and they don't always match. And so, Madam Chair, this issue came to me. Frankly, it's been around and on my desk every year that I've been here. So this is year 10. So we've reached a decade now where one particular neighborhood that is within the Edina city limits but is outside the Edina school district boundaries. And so I have heard from parents and even students from this particular neighborhood every year saying, how come these lines don't match up? And not always being able to give them a satisfactory answer to that, the next question is, well, what could we do to change those lines? What could we do to be a part of our school district within the city that we live? We want to be part of our neighborhood school district. And so this legislation, Madam Chair, is not an attempt to change the lines. It's an attempt to give these parents, this neighborhood, this community, a clear path. If you want to move from one school district to another, here is who you need to talk to, and this is who is the decider. Now, it's again, each of us has, I'm sure, has a school district boundary issue, has some parents, as a neighborhood that you could see would fit into this discussion. But my sense from these 10 years, Madam Chair, is that there's a frustration that it is not a clear process now. And, you know, I don't know if 10 years seems like a long time for state legislators, but 10 years is a very long time for parents trying to choose where to enroll their kids in school. 1 year is a long time. So, Madam Chair, if you would, I guess what I'd suggest at this point is that you hear from those who've been involved in this discussion, this particular neighborhood, and there is an A1 which would scope down this the scope of this bill. It would shrink down the scope, but I'd appreciate if you'd hear from kind of hear this story first.
You orchestrate that as to who's going to speak next.
Madam Chair, my name is James Erickson.
Mr. Erickson.
I have been retained. Solomon Strategies Group, our lobbying firm is Carrie Root and myself have been retained by the group called Unite Edina 273. And you see on the package in front of you a letter from them requesting the very specific action on the part of the Hopkins School Board that would consent to the process that Senator Michelle described. In the package that I passed out, this legislation is about one sentence in current state law. And the last page of the package that I passed out highlights that sentence. There is a process in state law, and it's, you have a copy of it in front of you, that allows for the attachment and annexation of a particular area or set of property owners. The law permits the county board to adjudicate whether that will happen. The law also has never, or I almost say has, to our knowledge, not been used, because it says before the hearing, that is before the county board, the consent of the board of the district which the area proposed for detachment lies in must endorse the petition. I want to thank Superintendent Schultz, who is here today from Hopkins. He has reached out to the Edina School District to initiate negotiations about this. This is the way it should happen. We hope the two districts could arrive at a process that would allow them to voluntarily and unilaterally and mutually themselves resolve this. Until that happens, we'd like you to consider this legislation, which would certainly permit it to happen. So with that in mind, I want you to know that that's what we're here about. The A3 amendment before you narrows the scope of this bill to a perhaps only a handful of circumstances. If you look at the A3 amendment, the A1 amendment, pardon me, narrows it to very limited circumstances, a very high bar to permit this to proceed without requiring the school district which detachment is proposed from blocking that process going forward. I'd like to ask Mr. Alan Kohler, the head of the group, he's also accompanied here by Mr. Todd Gersten, to testify with respect to the reasons for this, but I think they're self-evident, they're apparent, and Mr. Kohler will amplify that. His testimony is also contained in your package. Thank you.
Mr. Kohler?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alan Kohler, and I'm here speaking to you on behalf of over 400 families that live in this Parkwood Knolls neighborhood located in the northwest quadrant of Edina. Our neighborhood is subject to a boundary line that was established, best we can tell, in the 1880s and followed farm field fences, and also the best we can determine. The district of choice back in those days was what was the shortest route to a one-room schoolhouse, either on foot or on horseback. Now we move 130 years into the future, and these farm fields have been converted and transformed into an entire neighborhood, yet these boundaries remain. Yeah, one thing that does remain consistent is that our families look at what is the shortest route to our neighborhood schools. And what has happened over the past 30-odd years is that the schools of our serving district, in this case Hopkins, have migrated further and further away from our neighborhood, whereas we are literally ringed by three elementary schools within approximately 5 to 10 minute drive on residential streets, plus just a bit further, a junior high school and a senior high school. But we are in this paradigm where that is considered a different district than the one that's allegedly serving us. Now, for many of you who live in areas where your school districts can be quite expansive, you may think this is kind of a small matter. But even in a metro area like ours, we have determined that for a kindergartner to travel to the designated school in the Hopkins District versus one of our neighborhood schools in Edina, that child, if they took the bus to and from school every day during the kindergarten year, would travel the distance from Edina to Grand Marais. And if they continued on through their senior year of high school in the Hopkins School District, the additional travel distance would be going from Edina to Hanoi, Vietnam. So the distances you could perceive to be small, but in aggregate, it's actually quite large. And again, you know, in many outstate school districts, a long bus travel is unavoidable. In our case, it's entirely avoidable. I mean, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and I knew of kids that would eat lunch before they got to school because they'd been on the bus so long. But the point is that we're not dealing with two districts that are proximate to our neighborhood. We are dealing with a situation where only one district is proximate to our neighborhood, and that happens to be the Edina School District. Now, because of this, the families in our neighborhood have, over the years, decided with their feet as to where they wish their children to be enrolled. And it's gotten to the point where, of the school-aged children in our neighborhood, 63%, or 127, are enrolled in Edina schools versus 10 in Hopkins School District. 5% of our school-aged children in our neighborhood are enrolled in the quote-unquote serving district. And again, this comes back to the fact that the Edina schools are located next to our neighborhood. And so it's logical you would want your kids to attend the schools in very close proximity to your home. Now, as Senator Michelle alluded to, this has been an issue for the neighborhood literally going back decades. I've spoken with neighbors that have worked on this effort since the early 90s. And so we are yet the latest iteration of trying to conform a district to the life that exists today, not into the 1880s. We have gone out and spoken to our neighbors and done door-to-door surveys, and we have found support from 98% of our neighbors. And I'm sure you can appreciate that when it comes to matters of education, gaining 98% support on any topic involving education is quite extraordinary. So we are not just a few parents agitating because we have a certain belief. We are an entire neighborhood that over time has grown and developed, yet the boundaries do not conform to that development. And I'll just leave you on this one point, which I think is one of the most ironic points of this whole situation. And that is in 1893, so maybe 10 years after our boundary was established, 41 residents of what was then part of Minneapolis sent the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners a petition asking to secede from the city of Minneapolis. Well, they were allowed to proceed in an election. They held a referendum. And as a result of that, the municipality of West Minneapolis was created. This did not require the endorsement of both city councils. It required just a vote and the will of the people. We move forward a few decades, and the city of West Minneapolis became the city of Hopkins. So what you're asking you today is that we be allowed to undertake the same due process as those citizens did back in 1893 when they saw that the boundaries did not conform to their current lives and wanted to make a change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler.
And Madam Chair, we have one more testifier to talk a little bit more about this neighborhood perspective. If you'd allow another couple minutes, maybe time here. And while he approaches, Madam Chair and members, if I can make two more statements.
Yes.
First of all, if you do want to look at this as just Hopkins and Edina, these are all-star school districts. These are two of the best in the state. I have had the honor of representing each of them. I've been in the classrooms. I've met these students and teachers. These are great schools. What I'm suggesting, though, is we need to find a way to honor a neighborhood and a group of parents. What could be better? We've got parents really engaged in their kids' education. Isn't that what we want? That is something we need to celebrate around here, and I know this committee does. So again, I'm not trying to pit one school district against another. I'm trying to set up a process, a forum, a venue, so these folks can literally have their day to talk about where they'd like to send their kids to school. And I said two things. Here's my second thing that I wanted to raise with you. This issue becomes more acute, if that's the right way to say it, members, because depending on the year, open enrollment is not always available for those outside. Open enrollment into Edina districts is sometimes closed, okay? So it's not as easy as saying, okay, you guys, well, you live close to the Edina schools, you can just open enroll into it. That is not always available. Thank you, Madam Chair, for a little more commentary.
There was some numbers that were said earlier that only 5% of the children that live in that district are actually attending the Hopkins School District that they,
Madam Chair, that's
that
correct.
Live in? And what was the other percentage then?
There are 202 school-age children in our neighborhood.
Yes.
10 of those attend Hopkins, which equates to about 5%. And then 127 are open enrolled into Edina, which is about 63%. And the remainder attend either parochial schools or preparatory schools.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, if you would, Mr. Todd Gustin would like to add a little bit to this.
Mr. Gustin.
Gustin.
Gustin. Okay. Welcome, Mr. Gustin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify in support of this bill. Very much appreciate the time. I will be brief, given Mr. Kohler's detailed description. I was born and raised in Hibbing, Minnesota, and unfortunately Senator Tomasoni's left the room, but I had the good fortune of being one of his hockey students, I guess coming up on 30 years ago now. But I grew up very fortunate in that I walked to school with my neighborhood friends, and that was what I've come to realize a very unique thing, and something that while may not be practical in today's world as well as in a more metropolitan area, is the sense of community and the sense of shared experiences among the neighborhood children that were in my immediate surroundings is something that I hope to have for my kids. And that's the reason we moved into Edina, was for those shared experiences and for that sense of community. And unfortunately, we live in a neighborhood that we're not able to really benefit from those experiences, where we have my oldest daughter is open enrolling for kindergarten next year. She was put on the wait list through the Edina School District open enrollment process. She was 45th on the wait list. She's since moved up the wait list, but we're still now faced with the decision of choosing another school and determining where to send her. And unfortunately, that has resonated with most of the neighborhood children around us and her friends. And so we have a situation where school-age children have shared experiences across a variety of other programs, ranging from ECFE all the way into athletics and other arts and academic extracurricular activities, but they're not able to share their schooling together, and they're not able to go to school together. And as Mr. Kohler pointed out, the challenge for us is we have three schools in Edina School District that are within a mile or two of our homes, and the closest Hopkins School is a fair bit distance, twice or three times further away. And so our support for this bill does not have anything to do with the quality of schools. We think that Hopkins and Edina are both excellent schools. And in fact, my wife was a gymnastics coach for the Hopkins High School a period of years ago. And through that experience, we gained a real appreciation for the school, and we met a number of faculty and students and really admire what they're doing as a district. Unfortunately, the reality is it's just not a district that's in a school that's near our home. And so our community is in Edina, and that's where we share our experiences. So we believe that we ask that the committee and chair recognize that what we're trying to ask for is an ability to have our voices heard and allow the children's voices to be heard so that they can have the option of going to school together and really build that sense of community, which we believe sense of community and family is really the foundation for bringing children out. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here today. I've shared with Senator Michelle the neighborhood you're speaking of is actually the neighborhood I grew up in. So I now represent the Hopkins School District, and so I'm very concerned about the impact, if we were to pass this, would have on the Hopkins School District, and they will share just what kind of unintended consequences could occur should this all happen. But I want you to know it's been particularly strange for me watching this because I lived in that neighborhood, and I actually had friends across, you know, a block away who were in the very same situation, and we did have those discussions back then, and that was some time ago. I won't say how long ago, but it was a long time ago.
And it's not a new issue. I've heard it too. I've had people contact me, even though I've never represented Edina, but part of the Hopkins District, and that still has come up. Senator DeCrave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Michelle, one of your testifiers talked about the amount of
distance that over the course of their education they would travel. And you've got to understand that in districts that I represent, with consolidations, we have folks that find themselves living 5 miles from a town that they are not in that school district, and the town that they do belong to might be 25 miles away. So I haven't done the math, but I'm not, you know, and I don't remember right off the top of my head how far it is to the moon and back, but you go over the... Why wouldn't we open this up? You know, we've opened up open enrollment. Why wouldn't we open something like this up to all school districts and all communities to say, if we have an area here, if we have a town that is, because of redistricting, is now 5 miles from a school that they are all open enrolling to, why wouldn't it make sense to have the taxes follow?
Senator Crafe, I'm going to try to not make them answer that question.
Okay.
Probably because we're just a few days from the end of the session. but the reality, this I have grappled with since the first time I came here, because I was the first issue from a constituent that I was confronted with was about this very thing. This family had sent their kids to the parochial school in Mound. They were in a district that it was about 12 miles away. It was the headquarters, and the schools were all over there. And they said, our kids are going to go to the Westonka High School, and you have got until whatever that time was to get that squared away. And I thought, how in the world? Because all this property tax base, this whole thing, changing those boundaries is virtually an impossible feat. Well, in my first term here, with Governor Perpich, we got open enrollment, and it met that need. It has kind of softened or solved that for a time, but the reality is that we have got, for all the strange reasons, some of which are mentioned, as to how these boundaries were formed, we have some very, very strange arrangements of school district boundaries, and as long as we have a link to property tax for the support, we are going to have great difficulty of trying to unwind any of that. They have focused in on one very specific thing, this area of a district, and one that doesn't have any schools in it, so that, you know, they will still be would still be obligated for bonded indebtedness for other schools on that property. But it's in how things are funded in the link of that property tax. And I'm not, this is my last year, but that's a good thing for well, and you're hanging it up too. So it's easy for us to talk, but I do believe that they will be. That's an issue that I think may well continue as we look at scale of services and the cost of services. That it probably does need to be addressed, and what that final answer is. It is hard to determine, although, you know, I think they've raised some issues and an opportunity to examine some of that and see if there is a way that even among themselves that they could work out a transition that would make it possible to have it happen. But it's I agree with you. It'd be nice to be able to straighten out some of those things. If you look at these school district, a map of school district boundaries, it defies logic.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
If I could, I guess I want to agree with and reach out to both Senator Crafe and Senator Bonhoff. We don't want to be the school district boundary commission. You don't want a small group in St. Paul doing that. I think the compelling argument that these particular parents bring forward, but I think is shared by others in Senator DeKreif's description, is we do need to make sure that there's a process where these discussions can take place. And as it is now, if a school district or a school board says no, I mean, they effectively have a veto. And so the conversation ends and the frustration builds.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, and Senator Michelle, I think right now there actually is a conversation taking place between the two school boards and And I trust that is where these decisions really do have to take place, and that it really isn't the appropriate place to have the discussion. But I think by you bringing this forward, it's certainly elevated the conversation, and so this process is important in terms of you, citizens, being able to share your testimony and express your views. But the real issue is what Senator Olson said, and that has to do with those who voted for referendums and whose taxes have been going in one district and the hole that leaves abruptly when there's a change and all of those complicating factors. Yet, I am comforted in knowing that these two districts are now talking to each other.
I address that.
And Senator Bonoff, I think that is at the key because actually the process we have, nothing has ever happened. I mean, right. It essentially protects the status quo.
Right.
So if there was a sense that something was in the best interest of our system overall to have a change, we may have to look at the process. But clearly, the funding mechanisms are critical to it.
Madam Chair, might I address Senator Bonoff's question with this? She mentioned she used the word unintended consequences earlier, and there is a consequence of this that we understand is on the table and needs to be dealt with, and that is the loss of budgeted tax base in the Hopkins School District or a detaching school district that would accrete to the attaching school district. We very much appreciate Superintendent Schultz, and I suspect he'll address you here, and I hope he does, and I think he'll say exactly what Senator Bonoff said, that those discussions are going on. We honor the Hopkins School District and Superintendent Schultz's leadership in reaching out to Edina. Those discussions need to go on. I think this process, Senator Michelle's bill and Representative Downey's bill, has been very helpful to move that forward. We hope it continues to do so. We'll leave it to the will of the committee about what you do at this late date, but I think this airing of this issue is very appropriate. I fully expect that if both sides are in good faith to resolve and address the issues of these residents, they will reach an agreement that addresses the sum, I'm going to use the number $400,000 in general, of property tax base that is now being paid to the Edina, by these residents to the Hopkins School District for educating 10 students, and the $400,000 that would eventually shift at some time to the Edina School District to help Edina pay for the 127 students that they are educating. But I think that can be negotiated between the parties. I hope if you hear from Superintendent Schultz, he will tell you that that's happening. We just think that this process is appropriate. We think that some of the concerns, I understand Senator DeKreis' interest in solving the whole world's problems. We're not. We're interested in probably solving just ours, and I think the A1 amendment would do that. So I would encourage and hope the committee would at least put the bill in that shape and then do what you will with it while those discussions go on. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to do that. We know that that's a budgetary issue for Hopkins. We think that between Hopkins and Edina, they can resolve that fairly for all parties.
Well, the market value base is one thing, but really the issue here has to do with our formulas that are based on resident pupil units. And so there's the two forms, I believe, of the property tax income, and I think we will hear that from the superintendent, are generated by resident pupil units, whether they're attending the schools or not. And that I think, is that's where the rub is coming. Any further comments or questions? Otherwise, we are close to having to wrap up, and I'd like the superintendent to have an opportunity to. I think Superintendent Schultz is here.
No.
And his business manager, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been an interesting discussion, and I think this is just a symptom of something we're going to continue to bump up against these artificial boundaries in today, whether it's licensure, nurse licensure, teaching licensure, digital learning. And here's another case where we have what appears to be an artificial boundary that was from decades, maybe centuries ago, and maybe it's not working today. So I understand that predicament. On the other hand, and also in light with that, you know, this body and this legislature for a number of years has worked very hard to make sure that parents have choice, because we do know how important it is. We know parents are experts about their own children, and we like them to be able to choose where they go to school. So we've done a lot to do that, like open enrollment. And one could see that it's pretty much working here. We've got open enrollment, and it looks like the parents in this neighborhood are pretty much taking advantage of that. But the dilemma is, so we have a process here to allow for a boundary change, and yet I kind of get the feeling that you're just asking us to bypass this process. And it seems like, and I understand your amendment is very narrowly crafted. There are, you know, seven adjective identifiers here that basically limit it to the Hopkins and Edina. I don't think there's any other districts that would qualify. Yet, on the other hand, it's a little difficult to think about just making an exception. If the process is flawed, then maybe there needs to be a better look at the process. But on the other hand, we do have the open enrollment, which seems to be working. So I guess it's a difficult choice here. But I would like to see a better solution, I think, than the A1 amendment.
See, I think the issue is the open enrollment. The monies that are generated by the property tax don't go with the student to the school. We're part of the wrinkle here. So I'm not going to let us off the hook, but I think we need to understand the dilemma that is created. Superintendent Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Education Committee. Thank you for giving Hopkins Public Schools the opportunity to meet with you today as you examine this legislation. I want to introduce to you Mr. Tope, the Director of Business Services. He is a part a little later on. Our testimony will just discuss the current request before the Hopkins administration, then we'll spend some time talking about the fiscal and programmatic implications of this proposed legislation. We have met with Unite Edina, actually back in October 2010, as they came forward to explore the detachment and annexation. November 2010, our school board did hear from legal counsel regarding the annexation and detachment and the laws governing it, and then looking at the implications at that time. On March 22nd, House Representative's research staff informed me in her pursuit to gather information quickly that there was a bill being introduced to the House, and it proposed to amend the law to remove the detaching district's authority. The House committee moved this legislation without any information from the school districts, and the information we're presenting to you will clarify what the challenges are to this legislation. So I appreciate your deliberate approach to understanding the implications of this legislation. We believe that, as you've indicated, more thought and study needs to go into this issue before changing this public policy. Unite Edina Group, after the House passed, requested that Hopkins and Edina School Districts meet to establish a process for examining this request. And on April 18th, Dr. Rick Dressen, Edina Superintendent, myself, Mr. Tope, and their business manager, Margot Bauk, met to determine a process for examining this request. So both districts are in a position to collaborate around this issue. We are ready to understand how the Parkwood Knolls area land annexation would impact both districts. We will wait for a formal study request by the group to our boards and begin to take a look at what the impact is. Hopkins Public Schools and its governing leadership really needs to remain central in this discussion for many reasons. First, they are the governing body and the school taxing authority for all residents in the Hopkins boundaries. The detachment without a fiscal solution will first and foremost decrease resources to the learners of the district. The detachment of this property will result in a loss in the form of operating referendum dollars, capital project levy resource, which supports our curriculum and technology, and a loss of property value to the district. If this detachment were to happen without a process for filling the financial gap that would result, we will be forced to decrease the educational resources to children in instruction and educational technology. Could cause a decrease in teaching staff, curriculum support services, educational technology, hardware and software, and media resources. This decision would also result in an increase in the taxes of remaining residents in the Hopkins Public Schools. So these detaching residents would cause a tax increase to the residents who remain in the district. So we are concerned about that. I'm going to have Mr. Tope go through the kind of the science and the numbers behind this request and the impact these decisions will have on the school district's finance, if that's all right with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Tope?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just a real quick, brief background on fiscal impacts, a little bit of background information. First of all, the Hopkins School District serves seven cities. 64% of the city of Minnetonka is in the Hopkins School District. This portion of the market value of the city of Edina comprises 4.55% of the total of the city of Edina that is in the Hopkins School District. Total market value of this slice is about $400 million. There's about 467 parcels, 367 of which are homesteaded, 110 non-homesteaded, and 29 of those non-homesteaded properties are owned by a developer. So that's just information for the committee. Average market home value is $850,000. Median market value, $716,000, five times the average home price in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. The tax base, as I said before, is about $400 million, or 4.55%. That would be the loss to the Hopkins School District. It would result in a 5.16% annual gain for the Edina Public School District. The operating referendum impact, as Dr. Schultz said, the loss to the Hopkins School District is $281,000 annually, and it's a gain of $292,000 annually to the Edina School District. That's equivalent to about 6.5 teachers. The other revenue component is the capital projects levy for curriculum and technology that we have in the Hopkins School District. The Edina School District also has one. The approximate loss for the Hopkins School District is about $280,000. Edina Public Schools would gain about $232,000. Any future operating referendum, capital projects levy, renewals, and increases would be based, obviously, on a lower tax base for the Hopkins School District and a higher one then, obviously, therefore, for the Edina School District. There would be some other minor impacts to the community education levies based on population change and number of kids age 0 through 5 in the districts. For me, I believe that self-determination for these families occurred at the time of their home purchase. We believe that this issue should be negotiated at the local school district level. If Edina Public Schools and Hopkins Public Schools cannot reach an agreement, we may collaboratively decide this is not in the best interest of either school district and recommend rejecting a petition to annex. If there is legislation put forth to address this, I believe it should require school district level involvement as the first and potentially only step in the resolution process. Or alternatively, it addresses the additional fiscal impacts for the detaching district, not just the bonded debt. So before you today, if you allow this legislation to go forward and brings this to the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, this is about a $1.1 million decision impacting these two districts today as proposed, and this needs process behind it. So I agree with the chair's remarks earlier about process. I believe this statute is old. It needs to be changed, but this is not the time to change it when we're at the end of the session here. And we have one thing in front of us that would be changing it, unless you want to add some fiscal impacts behind it. Now, if you take a look at our operating referendum and our capital projects levy, and you want to put that in there with the bonded debt, you will be covering the proportionate share for those Edina residents. You will be covering 84% of our property tax levy. Could I live with that? Potentially, I could. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you clarify? Mr. Nauman, I believe that you said with the operating referendum that if that change was made, Edina would actually be able to collect and charge more. They apparently have a higher operating referendum, and it would automatically apply to this land. so that there would be a differential there, and you would lose. Although, and then the capital, but the capital was the other way around. What was the
Madam Chair,
explain that for me.
Madam Chair, the operating referendum currently in Hopkins is $1,755 per student. That will grow by about $30 to $40 per year until we reach the cap. The Edina School District is already at the cap of $1,824 per student, so that's why there is a difference. When those resident students detach from our district, we lose a little less than Edina gains. Capital projects levy for curriculum and technology is based on total adjusted net tax capacity. So that approximate number that I gave you is reducing our capital projects levy by the 4.55% and increasing the Edina capital projects levy by the 5.16%.
So, Madam Chair, can I just close? As you can see, this if detachment occurs without consideration being made for the loss of the financial resources, we will be forced to reduce the services to the children and families in Hopkins. We believe any detachment and annexation legislation must have mechanisms for providing resources for the loss of revenue a district will experience. Should all legislation, as we have indicated, and the United Edina has indicated, should also encourage districts to work together to understand the implications of any request. And these mechanisms need to be in place to hold districts harmless. So with that is our testimony regarding this, this bill.
So, Superintendent, your sense is that even if you were to work together and try to work out some type of arrangement, that is it within the authority of your districts to try to work out some transitional funding between the two districts, or would that require legislative action in your view?
Well, as the legislation sits now, it is only with the Hopkins School Board because they are the detaching district. So, but I believe that we can work this out together as a school district, as two school districts.
Well, but Superintendent Schultz, that's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah. If you were to work it out to a conclusion that would in fact allow the properties to relocate, it would be a fiscal. I'm just making an assumption there, but maybe that's not the assumption you're making in saying that you can work it out. Words can have different meanings depending on who's saying them.
Yeah.
If there was some transition in terms of the impact of that shift of revenue, is that within the authority of this process for the districts to make, or would it require any legislative change in order to bring that about? Because you're talking about the districts can, in fact, work it out. I would think that working that out would have to somehow cushion the blow, you know, the impact that it has on you. Although it is interesting that, you know, that the district that is serving a lot of these students is not benefiting at all from, because you're being able to spend the money on the districts that you're not, or on the students that you are serving but are not. And it's not these students. So, you know, there's the element of fairness. There's some other things going on here in the dynamics of what makes it complicated.
They get the per pupil, the state aid.
Madam Chair, might I address that specific issue? Under current law, the only issue that we're really dealing with is that the Hopkins School District or any school district proposing for detachment has a veto on the process going forward. We have formally asked the Hopkins School District to consent to our petition being filed. They are considering that, and we hope at the next Hopkins School Board meeting they will consider that. We would hope they would consent. If they do that, they put us into the statutory process that now we go to the Hennepin County Board, and four votes on the Hennepin County Board would approve or disapprove the petition. It would be a ministerial act, and there would be seven votes on the Hennepin County Board for it if both Hopkins and Edina come forward and say, we agree to this boundary change, just like you went through a legislative redistricting. We agree to this boundary change, and here are the terms and conditions negotiated between the two parties, and we understand the concerns of the Hopkins District, and we understand that since the Edina district would be, I won't use the term windfall, but would be the beneficiary of the change, I believe they have indicated they'd be willing to operate in some negotiated method. So we hope that this legislation, as limited as it is, simply says to Hopkins, you cannot veto our petition. We hope they will do so with the message that has been given to this committee at a near meeting. Then our petition will proceed to the Hennepin County Board, and all of those negotiations will go forward. And I think the Hennepin County Board, just as you would like the parties to come together. And if they come together with an approved process, an approved deal, an approved boundary change, an approved regime for dealing with the financial implications, intended or otherwise, I think that would be a seven-vote majority, and the Hennepin County Board would be yes, we bless that, and it would go forward. And no further legislation would be necessary. So the parties can do it. We simply want to get that process to the table, and we're asking respectfully Hopkins to agree. They are considering that. We hope they do so. We think this discussion has been very helpful and enlightening, and I was very pleased to hear Superintendent Schultz say that they were working on that and wish to continue to do it.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I know the hour is getting late, and I do know there's this whole group of parents, and only one of them, I believe, wanted to speak on their behalf.
Okay.
Madam Chair, can John Topman address your question you asked about the work with Edina District that we're doing?
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear,
Mr.
so
Mr.
Foote? Chair, just to be clear.
No, Mr. Tope.
Yes,
I'm
Mr.
Tope,
yeah. Just to be clear, the Hopkins School District has not said no or yes to a petition yet. In fact, we didn't have a formal petition in front of us to even bring to the board to consider until very recently.
Okay.
So just to be clear on that, I believe there can be something worked out between the two districts. But if you want to work out something that is mutually beneficial to both districts and vet that out and be able to communicate to our taxpayers in our district exactly what that impact is, that's going to take a little bit of time. And this is too short a time frame to do that in. If you pass something out of this committee today, I believe we can come to an agreement, but you have to let the two school boards work that out.
So if you were to allow, I think the concern they have is that you can block even the process from working.
But we haven't said no yet.
No, I know you haven't, but all you have to, you can write out the clock. We understand those things.
No,
here.
But I do want to address, Madam Chair, just one other issue with you. I don't believe we need additional legislation to do that.
That's the point. I think I'm asking this just for all of our understanding, is that your board could say no to the petition, which would not allow any further discussion to go forward to make this process work. And that all what they're saying is that's the part of this statute that bothers them, that one can block even the discussion or the presentation with if it's more neutral, I don't know what you'd say, the Hennepin County Board, which is already in the process, that's where it would go. And are you feeling that would push it too fast, that you wouldn't be able to work for that agreement in terms of a timeline? There's no timeline problems, is there, with even that Hennepin County process?
There is timelines attached in the statute to go to the Hennepin County Board.
How long is that? And is that sufficient time to allow the discussion or working for an agreement to come about? I think you did hand out the statute, Mr. Selman, and I don't know if any of us had a chance to look at it. We were so busy with our Board of Teaching applicants. But the statute's 123A.45.
Subdivision 3, Madam Chair, is where it addresses timelines.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, Subdivision 4, within 6 months of the filing of the petition, the county board must issue an order either granting or denying the petition.
So it has to
six months.
To work within a six-month time period then. Are there any? There was one person that wanted to speak.
Parents, yeah.
Is that Ms. Kelleher with a new hairstyle that I'm not recognizing you?
Oh, no.
Yeah. From the School Board Association, yes. Introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Marty Nelson. I live in Edina, within the boundaries of the Hopkins School District, and I'm here to speak against the proposed legislation. Our 17-year-old son, Eric, has been a student in Hopkins schools since he was 3 years old. I am an active parent in our school community and in the district at large, and I am a strong advocate for public education. Interestingly, both Senator Michelle and Representative Downey, sponsors of this legislation, have been guests in my son's school at my invitation over the past 9 years. Senator Michelle literally met my son while sitting on the floor with a group of first graders at Catherine Curran Elementary School. In addition to these visits in our school, the senator, representative, and I have met many times to discuss education legislation. I find this particular proposed bill disturbing on a number of levels. We've heard about the financial impact on taxpayers if a specially picked group of expensive homes were to be annexed to another district. This is a strong and compelling argument that must be considered carefully, given the significant portion of funding any school district receives from property taxes. If property taxes are how Minnesota intends to pay for public education in large measure, should it be the county commissioner without direct input from the affected school boards, who the local control, who make that decision? Now, laying aside the fiscal issue, my fundamental objection to this bill stems from my position as an affected resident of the neighborhood. It was stunning to me to see that while my neighborhood is just across Nine Mile Creek from Parkwood Knolls, the neighborhood in question, farther south and farther than they from Hopkins Schools, our neighborhood is not being considered integral to the annexation issue, nor are the apartments or townhomes that flank the east side of 169 Highway just north of the crosstown. In 2010, my neighborhood received flyers asking for our support in the Unite Edina effort. I contacted them and told them that not only would I not support it, I would actively work against it, and that I was insulted by their veiled assumption that one district was better than the other. I then contacted each of the Hopkins School Board members, Superintendent Schultz, and I also had a lengthy conversation with a director in the office of the Edina Superintendent. I was assured that the law, as it stood, provided for school districts to have local control over how a move like this would proceed, and that it would be a long process of collaboration. So imagine my surprise when I received a call from Superintendent Schultz a few weeks ago telling me that Representative Downey had brought forward this bill. Though an Edina resident, we are a Hopkins family. Our son has more than a decade of the superior education in our Hopkins schools. We identify with Hopkins. He played Little League in Hopkins. We participate in the life and community of Hopkins schools. And now, when a dissatisfied group of homeowners decide that they would prefer something different, they wish to change the law. Now, perhaps as a passionate parent,
I see
this too simply, but bear with me. A person looks for a home with a lot of factors in mind. If you have children or you plan to have children, the school district serving the area where you want to buy a home is extremely important and perhaps the primary component of the neighborhood where you will search. In Minnesota, as has been mentioned today, we have school choice. Parents can buy a home in a district, but then choose to send their children to any number of types of school, a different public school, a private or parochial school, or they can homeschool. Now, like everything in life, if you want to exercise your choice, you accept the responsibility for that choice. Fiscal responsibility if you choose private or parochial, time to organize, teach, and guide when you homeschool, time and money on transportation to an open-enrolled public school,
And if you intend to open enroll, you assume the risk that a district may close. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. We bought in the Hopkins District in the city of Edina because the neighborhood, the house, and the school district suited us. That's what you do when you buy a home. You weigh those considerations and you make your choice. What Could does you, not make you know, a bit of sense to me, and pardon my passion, as a homeowner and as a property taxpayer who counts on educating my child in the school district in which I bought my home, why would legislation be written to make it easier for a privileged group of homeowners to take that away from me? Now, let's say...
Oh, just a minute. I think you've made your case, and we are going to have to wrap up here, but are you in the area that is asking to be, or are you in another part of Edina that is not being included in the petition?
Madam Chair, I'm farther away from Hopkins than the Parkwood Knolls neighborhood.
And you are in Edina?
I am in the city of Edina, and okay. My property taxes go to Hopkins, and my son has been a student in Hopkins. Okay. And we
so
have
you're
neighbors.
Not one, you're not one of the 10 out of the 202 in this neighborhood that are not attending the Hopkins.
Madam Chair, I haven't seen the actual data, and I'm basing my statements on a map that I located on the internet from the Patch publication, and there was a purple highlighted area, and we're farther south. Mm-hmm. And if the argument is that we are needing to be close to a neighborhood school, I'm within 2.5 miles of 5 Edina schools, and it was my choice to buy in a neighborhood in the Hopkins School District.
That's we got that message. Senator Stumpf.
Madam Chair, this is a much more interesting fight than the Minneapolis-St. Paul equity fight.
I don't know about that.
I don't know. I'm not sure there's an answer to this one.
Well, I've been here 30 years, and I haven't had the enlightened view that how you ever deal with the boundary change issues within school districts. Because we've had a very good example here of the differing views, and way back when those boundaries, people had a choice. They actually had a choice of whether they wanted their property to be a part of one district or another. And that's why we have some strange patchworks, is that some made a choice to be with one district and one with the other. We have had in the Mound District, where the main body of schools are, people can look out the window of their homes and see the schools, but they're in a district whose schools are 9 or 10 miles away. So it's all over, and it is a bigger issue. And I think I thank you for your testimony, because I think you've added to the complexity of the nature of this issue. But Senator Stumpf.
Senator Wieger.
Senator Stumpf has already had his
point. Madam Chair, I agree. This is complex. We're late in the session. There are three different possible scenarios where this could directly impact in one of the school districts that I represent, and actually in two of the districts I have. And because of the lateness, questions that need to be resolved, I would move that we table this.
Okay. Can you wait? We would like to have the school board people have a chance to have a say before we
I'll act. Withdraw that motion, but we'll make it
all right
thereafter.
Okay. Thank you very much. I didn't get the person's name. Marty Nelson? Yeah, thank you very much, Marty. Or Ms. Nelson. And Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have some very strong concerns about this bill. And I love working with Senator Michelle. I think he has been exceptional on this and other issues. But this might be the worst bill this session.
I renew my motion.
Ms. Kelleher, how do you really feel about it?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I think I at least have the ability to say that this is the first time that Ms. Kelleher has said anything to me about this bill. So I think I got a clear message of it now, but it would have been nice to hear a little earlier so we would have had the ability to work on it, because now, as the days and hours start to tick, as you said, Madam Chair, we all know how to slow things down.
Senator Hand?
Madam Chair, and I apologize. I've been in and out of the room, and I have done a little bit of reading of this before we had the hearing today and talked with Senator Michelle briefly, and I've talked to the superintendent of Hopkins, and I'm just going to pose this as a question, and maybe Senator Michelle or others would comment on it. It seems to me that there is a concern about the money, and then there's a concern about the parents and their affiliation with the school. Is there any thought of trying to construct a compromise that would allow the district boundary lines to change if there was a provision that would allow for the financial aspect of this to be remain relatively unchanged or at least transitioned over some period of time? In other words, if the parts of the funding that are not associated with the enrollment of students, the levies and so forth, if there was a plan to allow the Hopkins District to retain that funding so that their funding base is not disrupted dramatically, at least over some period of time. Is that, and I'm just sketching out a concept, not a detail, but is that something that's workable?
Senator Hand, I think that was the idea of having the districts work together, that they, in fact, would have the authority to work that out. But the issue with the current statute is that one board can stop that conversation even.
But I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if there was an amendment to this bill that would provide for that in more specificity, that would direct that conversation, if that would be acceptable as a compromise. That's really my question.
Okay. Senator Michelle or Ms. Kelleher or Superintendent Schultz?
Madam Chair, just to try to address Senator Hand's question, as a member of the legislature, I would say yes, I'd be open to that kind of discussion. But I think this maybe beyond your question, Senator Hand, but this kind of proves the point. We should not be the school district boundary commission. And those questions about money or operating revenues and referendums and others should fit into this process. And our only point is you don't even get to start. You don't even get past go if one of the school districts says, nope, we're not interested. And so I think that's where you want this to continue towards the county.
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, and I apologize for not speaking earlier to Senator Michelle, but as a school district, we purposefully try to stay away from local individual school issues. What we see is a process in law created in the last time changed in 2001 that effectively mandates that two school districts come together and approve it to move the process to the county board. What is happening is you're hearing a very vocal group of parents with concerns about their children doing an end run. Basically, they don't like what they're seeing, so they're trying to change the law to fit their situation. It's a bad precedent. And it's bad for Senator Stumpf's area, and it's bad for outstate. And I think once you take the cap off this bottle and say you can come here, actively get your parental notions heard, there's no putting it back, Madam Chair. And there's got to be some stability to the funding of public education.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we made that clear, and I hope I made that clear early on. This is a complex issue, and it's broader than this particular thing. You're saying one thing that I'm hearing something different. The Hopkins superintendent has said, well, we can't enter into any of this discussion until we have the petition and decide. So, in other words, they would make the decision before they could have the discussion of working out something. And that is kind of a backwards approach. It would seem to me somehow there would have to be a way of having some negotiation before you would do the up or down veto to take it to the county board. and then start the timeline. But it appears that they don't feel that that is the case, that once they get that petition, you've got to make that decision. And that I wonder if there's something in that aspect that along the way. We're not going to have a chance to resolve this session. So, Senator Wieger, I think we've heard from the folks. Senator Wieger has moved to lay the bill on the table. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And Senator Tomasoni, you just inadvertently left the room and missed the opportunity that one of our testifiers, Mr. Gustin, said I was a part of one of your hockey schools. And
he
from
here.
He's right there. He's right here. So I'm glad you came back. And I want you to tend to that business.
You were about this big.
All right. So I think the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.